You're listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends, the number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism. Broadcasting live from Florida's Suncoast on WTMY Sunday Travel Radio. Don't forget, you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's our host, the travel guy, Roy Lowy.
Thank you, Greg. My guests today are author and executive director of the Center on Ecotourism and Sustainable Development, Martha Honey. Bonnie Neely, travel journalist and director of RealTravelAdventures.com. It gives me great pleasure to welcome our next guest, Martha Honey. Martha, welcome to Talking Travel.
Thank you, Roy. It's great to be on your show.
It's great to have you on again.
Thanks.
And there's a new book out, and it's called Ecotourism and Sustainable Development, Who Owns Paradise? Who does own paradise?
Well, that's one of the contests that's going on around the world between local communities, indigenous people, and tourism, which is the largest industry in the world and is moving aggressively into some of the last remaining lovely places around the world to buy them up for the pleasure of people in countries like ours.
Yeah, you know, I'm very, it's a very close to home item for me. I lived in the Dominican Republic for some time and was kind of a pioneer in developing ecotourism, as we then were calling it. And also, I was in Africa during the times that you mentioned, and we might just mention that you start out the book. Well, I don't know; I may have jumped around in it a little bit, but we talk about during the late 1980s, many of the third world countries turned to ecotourism as a foreign exchange earner that was potentially less destructive than alternatives such as logging, oil extraction, cattle, bananas, commercial fishing. And conventional mass tourism. And I thought, you know, you're absolutely right on it. That's exactly what was happening.
Yes, I think so. And I think what was, you know, one of the things, there were several things propelling it, but one was that developing countries, and I was living in first in Tanzania and then in Costa Rica, so sort of saw it firsthand,
right,
was that developing countries were being sort of told, particularly in Africa, by the World Bank, by USAID and other development agencies, that tourism was a good way to develop. And so a lot of the countries moved into tourism very aggressively, supported by loans from the developing from these development agencies. And they found that many of these countries began to find that they actually were gaining very, very little from tourism. I was living during the 1970s and 1980s, first in East Africa and Tanzania and then in Costa Rica. And I think one of the things that we saw in those countries was that many of them had moved into tourism as international tourism, as a development tool supported by the World Bank, by USAID and other international agencies,
right,
and took out loans to develop tourism sectors and then began to find that basically they were gaining very little from tourism and were facing a lot of social and environmental problems as the money from the tourism left the country because it was usually foreign firms that owned it and managed these hotels and the tourism infrastructure.
Right.
And then they were left with things like black marketeering and sex tourism and eventually AIDS and so on, and also environmental degradation from some of the hotels and so on that were built badly and too many tourists in some places, et cetera. So some of the developing countries began to say to the World Bank and to the Inter-American Development Bank and other agencies that this was not a good development tool. And in fact, in the late 70s, both the World Bank and the IDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, closed down their lending for tourism completely because of pressures from developing countries. And it wasn't until really the 90s that then these agencies began to move back into tourism. But at that point, they began to do it under the rubric of ecotourism or what's now being called sustainable tourism and so on, responsible tourism. It goes by many names. But basically tourism that is more environmentally and socially sensitive and tries to also patronize local businesses. And so when we now see that the development agencies are again back into tourism, and oftentimes it now is couched in the framework of the principles of ecotourism.
Well, what I thought also was extremely interesting is the comparison of what an animal is worth. As we all know, and as you've mentioned in your book, years ago in Africa, it was all about hunting. And at the time, I was working for Sir Freddie Laker with British United Airways, and we flew into Kenya, and I had a small safari company, but it was a photo safari, which was all quite new in those days. And but when you actually made a comparison of the value of an animal that you're photographing or seeing over and over again versus one that you shoot and take home as a trophy. For example, you say in Kenya it is estimated that one lion is worth $7,000 per year in income from tourism, and an elephant herd is valued at $610,000 annually. And the comparison again in the Turks and Caicos, where I've spent quite a bit of time, the spiny lobsters are prized by recreational divers and therefore may actually be more valuable in the water for ecotourists than for the dinner table. And that's so true.
Yep. It is. And although I do think that the whole issue of hunting is it's a very contentious one, sort of within the field of responsible tourism or ecotourism. And I do think that in some instances, what we're seeing now in places in Africa, for instance, where the game parks are, you know, are really well managed, these are in many ways artificial constructs. I mean, somebody, usually the colonialists, drew a line around and said, okay, this is a game park, and they threw the local people out, kept the animals in. But of course, the animals don't respect those boundaries. And so one of the things that happens in Kenya and in Tanzania and in southern Africa is that the elephants and the other animals wander outside the parks, and now you've had people, you know, doing agriculture and so on right on the edge of the parks, and there becomes a conflict on the edges of the parks between people and the animals. And in some cases, not always, but in some cases, there are actually too many of those animals for the ecosystem, for the size of the park, and either they're going to die off out of natural, you know, drought will come and so on, and they will die off, and sort of nature will take care of it. Or in some cases, and there's been a very innovative project called Campfire in Zimbabwe, where communities living on the edge of the parks were permitted to do some trophy hunting with basically, you know, foreigners coming in and earning money for the village, because these are elephant or other animals that would have to be what's called culled. They would have to be killed by the rangers anyway, because there were too many for the size of the parks. So, I mean, I happen to believe, even though I don't personally like hunting, that it is better, rather than to have a ranger simply kill the animal, let the communities bring in a hunter and make some money off of killing them. But this is very controlled. This is not the kind of rampant hunting that we saw sort of back in Teddy Roosevelt's day of going in, you know, shooting everything in sight and bringing it home on a ship. This is very, very controlled and high-price hunting, and only in special circumstances.
And, of course, there's importation restrictions on bringing hides and that sort of thing into this country anyway. So where is it headed? You covered so much in the book, and then, of course, you know, in Costa Rica and those areas, it was sort of a photocopy of what had happened in Africa, but then they expanded on it. Let's talk about that a bit.
Talk about Costa Rica.
Yeah, Costa Rica and how, you know, how they expanded on what they learned from what was happening in Africa. I think one of the biggest things that caught my eye in all of this is that, as you just mentioned, that the people who were living in the areas of the parks weren't making any money off of this. All the money was going elsewhere. And I've seen that in the Dominican Republic and other places that I've spent a lot of time in. So obviously they weren't cooperative. And in fact, in many cases, they were destructive and discouraged the tourism because it didn't mean anything to them, because the only work that was it was bringing in is maybe some jobs in the restaurants and that sort of community.
I think that what we've seen in places in Africa also is that sometimes the people living around what are the prime tourism game parks and so on are some of the most socially, economically marginalized in the those countries, the Maasai and other pastoralists in East Africa, and what are known as the Bushmen or the Khoisan in Southern Africa. And so one of the challenges is, you know, how to bring these people into tourism and give them real benefits from tourism, because they oftentimes are don't have any of the skills, not even literacy and so on, because they have been so marginalized from even the predominant black society in post-colonial eras. And this has been, you know, this has been a real challenge. And I think there have been some models that have been developed where communities have partnered with, for instance, particularly in South Africa, have partnered with reputable tourism operators who provide the lodge, they bring in the tourists and so on, and provide a kind of quality control, and also provide training for local people to become guides, to work in the hotels and take part in different aspects of tourism if they want to. And they also provide a kind of rent that goes to the whole community for the use of the land, and sometimes sort of a tax, a head tax, a bed night tax that also goes to the community. So it's a partnership where the community is in partnership with a high-end tour operator and is basically guaranteed that they'll get a steady stream of business, because tourism is a very difficult business to run. In other parts of the world, and I think Costa Rica is a very good example of this, where you have a higher level of education, you basically got a rather strong middle class in Costa Rica, so you've got a kind of healthy, well-educated workforce, a good infrastructure and so on. It's more possible for local people, for Costa Ricans, to actually run tourism businesses themselves. And so we see in Costa Rica much more sort of vibrant community-based ecotourism and even middle-level tourism that is owned by Costa Ricans, and even some of the big hotels are. You have sort of the whole range, so it's not all owned by either a foreign elite or a local elite, but you have really the middle class, and in some instances the lower middle class, being able to tap into some of the income that's being generated through tourism.
Right, and share in the revenue. That's exactly true. A lot of the farming people obviously own that land, and they've made it available for various tourist projects.
Right, and I think that one of the things we've seen and has been urged in Costa Rica and other places is that, for instance, for a farm, they may, you know, what's called a finca in Costa Rica, they may put up a few cabins and take in, you know, guests in those cabins, but they continue to be involved in farming, or they may do horseback riding or hiking tours on their farm, or, you know, agricultural tours and so on to their gardens, especially if they're involved in organic gardens. So they may have a butterfly farm, or they do some touristic activity, but it doesn't mean that they abandon the farming completely, so that they've diversified their income sources.
Right.
And I think this is really smart, because what we're seeing now, of course, with the economic crisis starting here in the U.S. and going global, developing countries are going to be, that are tourism dependent, are going to be very badly hurt. And so if they either have a strong domestic tourism market or have people involved in tourism who are also have their fingers in other economic activities, that can cushion the impact when the international tourism dries up or becomes, you know, goes downhill.
In the Dominican Republic some years back, and I started an ecotourism company there, as I had mentioned earlier, we went to areas like Lago Enriquillo, where they never really had any tourists. If they were, they were basically day trips. And we created some overnights where we did rivers, waterfalls, all the things that a lot of the European tourists were interested in. But the people in those areas, there weren't any hotels, so I literally knocked on doors and asked if they would be willing to put up people in their local houses, which in many cases didn't have bathrooms.
Uh-huh.
And so they had outhouses, and then we went down to the rivers to wash up. And in the beginning, I can recall the Germans particularly, they were saying, was ist los, you know, how do we do this? And the same with the food. They weren't, you know, they were very just local type restaurants, and so I made prior arrangements, and And when I would tell them that there was goat on the menu, they would want to know which was the goat. And I said, no, I'm at the end of the dinner, you pick out which meats that you like the best, and then I'll tell you which one is the goat. which they of course called Chibo, and interestingly enough, probably 9 out of 10 picked the goat as the favorite dish. And had I told them previously, I think that wouldn't have happened.
Yep, that's great.
But it goes back to where the people were happy because they were involved in this. They were mm-hmm. getting income. It wasn't large income because, you know, we're staying, and I used to bring, we supplied them with fans and mosquito netting mm-hmm. during the season when that was necessary. And we paid the park rangers a little bit extra. And on occasions, because we had vehicles, if someone was sick, we actually had to evacuate them from not one of the tourists, but to the local people, where we actually save lives of children who were ill that we drove to places. So to me, I felt that was what ecotourism, and as you now call sustainable tourism development, is really all about.
It is, and that's really an excellent example, and great that you were involved in sort of the early days of creating what is now known as ecotourism. And I think even pushing it a little bit farther, we have another concept that we call traveler's philanthropy. And this was really when I was working on the first edition of this book in the mid-90s and was, you know, going to different countries around the world and looking at ecotourism projects. And what I found again and again was many places like you described in the Dominican Republic where the tour operator or the travel operator was sort of the only source of income, real income, in a particular destination. And so they became, and they also tended to be people like you who really cared about the location and the people in the location and felt a kind of civic responsibility towards them. And so they began to do kind of good works or, you know, provide benefits to the community, like taking sick people to the hospital or fixing motors that were broken or mm-hmm. providing, you know, supplies that were hard to get and all sorts of basic things. And I was really impressed by what some of these tour operators, you know, in very distant places in Fiji and in parts of Africa and in parts of the Americas and so on, were actually doing in terms of providing real tangible benefits to the host communities. Now, obviously, the host communities were making the tourism possible, so it is a reciprocal agreement. It shouldn't be viewed as just charity. It's really give back to the community.
Right.
And we, since then, have started a project that we call Travelers Philanthropy, and it is to look in a more organized way at how both tour operators, lodges, different parts of the tourism industry, and the people, their guests, the people who travel with them, can in a systematic way give back to the communities. And we're actually doing a big conference in early December over in Tanzania, bringing together companies from around the world with development agencies and so on and people from local communities to discuss what has become this kind of growing form of development assistance that is flowing from tourism into destinations where the tourism is taking place. It can be done in great ways. It can also be done in ways that are very destructive. And so one of the things that the organization I'm director of is working on is how to talk about ways that to do this kind of development assistance in ways that really does benefit the community, that is in partnership with the community, that the community identifies what needs they want met, whether it's a new school or a clinic or, you know, scholarships for worthy students or whatever it is. They make that determination. It's not made by the tourist who says, well, I want to give T-shirts or I want to give, you know, bubble gum or whatever, pens and pencils to the schools. It's something that actually comes from the community and is organized. So you don't have this kind of one-off charity that you oftentimes see between, you know, a tourist who out of, the right place in his heart wants to give to someone who appears to be needy. But oftentimes that just perpetuates a kind of cycle of begging and dependence and so on. And so also to move tourists to think more strategically about, yes, it is very important to give back to the people and give back to the destination you're visiting, but do it in a way that is organized and is really contributing to models of development that are viable within those communities and that have been identified as being viable. And so we see again and again the tourism businesses is kind of a hub for helping to collect and then disseminate this form of development assistance to communities.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think unless you've had third world experience living in third world countries as you have, people who create charities don't really understand where it needs to go in many cases, as you've mentioned. For example, in the Dominican Republic, a child can't go to school unless they have a uniform.
Right.
Well, it's no good giving money to people. What we did is we created a group of we've hired people, you know, with the sewing machines, mm-hmm. and actually made the uniforms. And
so you're creating an income-generating activity.
That's exactly right.
It's filling a need. That's
and
great.
And supplying the children with the uniforms, yeah. because they couldn't go to school if they didn't have one, and then the families couldn't afford them. And a lot of places, as you well know, they just don't understand the value of education in many cases. I mean, this is changing, obviously, but
right.
over the years it was more important to have the children at home helping around and collecting water.
Well, they didn't have any choice. There was labor that had to be done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I found that in so many cases, as I explained with the situation in we tried to keep the numbers down as well. I think that you can if you bring in too many people too often, it can overwhelm a small community.
Right.
So it was easier to control the numbers for us, and it was also better for the community and of course the areas and that's important. It was
yes.
one, and so I think you've covered that very, very well in your book. Let's just chat a little bit more about Costa Rica, because Costa Rica,
yes.
as you say, has taken on the lead in this, at least on this side of the pond. And I think that there are a lot of countries, you know, around Central America in those areas. Jim Fowler, for example, of Mutual of Omaha fame, is discussing the possibility of building a ecological resort, animal resort. I don't know exactly what he's planning on calling it. In Panama, and I think Panama is probably as beautiful to me as Costa Rica is,
yeah.
and probably less expensive these days. But they haven't really caught on to what's happening in Costa Rica or has happened over the years.
Well, I think that that's right, and I think, you know, Costa Rica is a very important country to pay attention to, because it is, in a way, kind of a bellwether. It is both, you know, a beacon light of the best of ecotourism, but it also is a warning light of overdevelopment, particularly on its coasts. And we actually now, backed by the government, are involved in a big study that's really looking in detail at the development that's gone on and is continuing to go on along Costa Rica's Pacific coast,
right.
where it's not ecotourism. It is, you know, basically big resort tourism,
yep.
and also tied to vacation homes. And this is a very different animal from ecotourism. And we believe, from everything we know, and it also this is where some of the cruise ships come in on both coasts as well, which is another kind of tourism that is extremely different from, much, much different from ecotourism. And, you know, not just in terms of its social and environmental, but also the economic impacts. I mean, basically what we have found is that ecotourism puts a lot more money into the local economy than cruise tourism does or resort tourism does. Both of those models, cruise tourism and resort tourism, have structural models that try to keep all of the money within the company, within the entity,
right.
and not spread it out into the communities. Ecotourism is largely the opposite of that. It's people getting out, learning about different parts of the country, spending money in all different places. The money gets moved around the country in a much more profound way than it does with either cruise tourism or resort tourism. So I think we need to pay attention to Costa Rica, both because it's been such a leader in ecotourism and because now, unfortunately, it has this kind of dual personality of having another kind of tourism, big tourism, on its Pacific coast that the evidence is showing, and we're in the middle of doing this study, so we don't have all the data yet, is not beneficial, is not nearly as beneficial as ecotourism to the country, and may actually be a negative benefit. There are all sorts of negatives to it in terms of the environmental, social, and changing the image. A tiny country like Costa Rica, I think one of the difficult things is that unless you're a really big country like the U.S. or Brazil or whatever, where you can have kind of different parts of the country that are known for different things, ecotourism, resort tourism, cruise tourism. In a tiny country like Costa Rica, you can really only have one image. And Costa Rica has won the image, rightfully so, as being an ecotourism destination, but it's on the cusp of perhaps losing that. I think that it moved into ecotourism in a very smart and concerted way, actually beginning when Oscar Arias was the president the first time. He's the president again now.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s, when we were living there, the late 80s, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And that, it's very interesting, the connection between peace and good tourism, I think, is integral. But it was at that point that he won the Nobel Peace Prize for basically being the architect of the Central American Peace Plan, which, at least on paper, ended the wars in Central America. It did end the war with Nicaragua, and it slowed down the wars in Salvador and Guatemala. And once those wars were, you know, essentially over, people could then turn to other things like tourism. And I was working as a journalist in Costa Rica, and it was sort of like overnight we didn't have any kind of political, military operations to be covering, and people began saying, well, wait a minute, but this country has these incredible national parks, and there's all these, you know, it's got this wonderful biodiversity and within a very small geographic area and so on. And so people began to write about sort of the other side of Costa Rica, which was also that it had didn't have an army. It had abolished its army several decades before, in the late 1940s. It had public education, free public education through universities. It had all these kind of remarkable facets to it that hadn't really been covered well when it was just kind of this what's called the Southern Front for the U.S. war against Nicaragua. And suddenly these other things were allowed to kind of shine, and people began to take an interest in Costa Rica for its environmental and its social policies, and tourism really took off in the late 80s, and it took off, I think, in a very good way, with it being small-scale, concentrated in the highland areas around the national parks, with both Costa Ricans and long-term foreigners who were living in Costa Rica, a lot of them Americans, but a number of them Europeans, who were basically, essentially, Costa Rica had become their home, and so the money that they made from tourism was reinvested into Costa Rica. It wasn't taken out of the country, or most of it was reinvested into Costa Rica. So you began to have, Costa Rica, I think, had the right stuff to do ecotourism well. It had a good park system, it had a good infrastructure, a close proximity to the U.S., and, as I said, a healthy, well-trained workforce, well-educated and well-trained workforce that could move into tourism. And so it had the right ingredients to really move into ecotourism, and it also had governments that were very much interested in promoting ecotourism. And so it really did, within a decade, in fact, within less than a decade, it was being touted as the ecotourism destination in the Americas and in many places.
And now it's a matter of sustaining it.
And this is a real struggle.
Right.
And there are, you know, there are people in Costa Rica who either don't understand or are just making too much money out of big tourism, and there is a real struggle now and a real, real concern among lots of people in Costa Rica that they may be losing it. And this move to places like Nicaragua or Panama as kind of the new frontiers by, you know, investors usually from the U.S. is symptomatic of Costa Rica, one, beginning to sort of lose some of its glow and its gloss, but also prices going up in Costa Rica so much that it's cheaper to build and buy in Panama or Nicaragua these days, or Salvador or Guatemala. And so, you know, people are looking elsewhere. And I think, you know, we're in the middle of this study, but one of the warnings is that Costa Rica needs to very quickly pay attention to, you know, learn the lessons of what's happened on the Pacific and try to stop this kind of big development so that it doesn't spread all the way down into a region known as the Osa Peninsula, which is one of the most important places on the planet in terms of rich biodiversity, and there are plans for big tourism there, which, you know, many of us feel would be disastrous.
A little scary, yeah.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Jennifer Rice, and her daughter started an organization. She has two small boutique hotels in Costa Rica, and they started an organization called Kids Saving the Rainforest.
Yes. Oh, I know that, and I know the place.
You do? Okay. Yes. They call it the Blue Monkey.
Yes, exactly. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah,
yes.
Jennifer's a long-time
friend.
I've
stayed there several times.
Yeah, Jennifer's a good friend, and I've known her for years and years. In fact, we all lived in St. Thomas at one point.
Oh.
In any event, one just quick note before we go, and that is that you might find it interesting, as you know, we have a lot of farmland here in Florida, and in Manatee County, which is part of... part of the area that we're in, one of the dairy farmers has just recently opened an ecotourism farm where you can come out and see the milking of cows, and they do a cookout lunch, and so it's interesting that even the farmers are recognizing this. I mean, at least in this area. That there's other ways of saving their land
right.
when things get a little tough
right.
on trying to make money with milk and dairy products. Mm-hmm. That there's another solution, and ecotourism is certainly one of them.
Right. Well, you may have noticed that in the book, I actually the completely new chapter is on ecotourism in the U.S.
And right.
I had organized a couple of years ago what was the first ever conference on ecotourism in the U.S., and it was just fascinating. We held it in Bar Harbor, Maine, and now it's become kind of an institution being held either every 2 years or every year along with Canada, so the sort of North American ecotourism. But I think that, what we found, and you're a living example of this, is that oftentimes people in this country moved into ecotourism after they went overseas, either lived overseas or traveled overseas, and saw or were involved in ecotourism and brought home, it's kind of chickens coming home to roost, they brought home the ideas and the concepts of ecotourism and are applying them in this country. And it's oftentimes the poor areas where it's the family farms that are losing out, or
right.
in West Virginia where, they're losing out to big coal mining and so on, where it's the same kinds of struggles over who owns paradise, who controls this land in this country that we've seen in developing countries. In fact, in the U.S., one of the things that I believe is true, I argue in the book, is that ecotourism actually started in kind of our peripheries in Alaska, in Hawaii, and also in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
A good point.
Where we
yeah.
have had some of the early experiments in ecotourism, partly because, at least in Alaska and Hawaii, we had strong indigenous populations. And there was a need, they were involved in struggles, and there was a need to really do tourism in ways that was culturally sensitive and provided benefits to the indigenous people, to the native people, and so on. So we saw the earliest kind of experiments with ecotourism there, and then it moved to the lower 48. And we are seeing it all across the United States. And Florida has a number of great examples of ecotourism. And I think it is growing, again, not organized, in part because we don't have a national tourism agency in this country. So everything is very decentralized on a state level. So it's hard to kind of get a national image for ecotourism because it's all done on a state basis.
And hopefully,
but definitely people are turning to it as a way of protecting what they care about and, supplementing incomes that may be drying up for various reasons.
Very, very well put, Martha. Our guest has been Martha Honey, Executive Director of the Center of Ecotourism and Sustainable Development. She is also a freelance journalist in Latin America and Africa, has worked for The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Associated Press, ABC TV, and the BBC. She has received numerous awards for her investigative journalism. Her book is called Who Owns Paradise, and it can be purchased on the web by going to www.islandpress.org. Martha, I thank you very much.
Check our website. It is ecotourismcesd.org, and you'll see that there's an advertisement and how to order the book on our website as well.
Thank you for joining us, Martha. It's
Thanks
been a pleasure.
Take care, Roy. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye. This is Roy Lowy, and you're listening to Talking Travel on WTMY 1280 Sarasota and worldwide on TTRN.com. If you have any questions for any of our guests, you can email them directly to me, Roy at TTRN, and we'll attempt to answer them for you. It gives me a great pleasure to welcome back our old friend Bonnie Neely. And Bonnie is a travel journalist and director of RealTravelAdventures.com. Welcome to Talking Travel once again, Bonnie.
Hi, Roy. It's great to be back. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. And you've been, since we've last spoken, you sure have been getting around.
That's what we travel writers do, isn't it?
It sure is. And you spent 3 wonderful weeks in China.
Yes, we did. Prior to the Olympics, just prior to them, we had figured that this might be an excellent time because the country was ready for visitors, but wouldn't be so expensive yet, and not so crowded. And we figured it just right, I believe.
And where did you leave from, Bonnie?
We traveled from the Dallas area.
Okay, and did you were you able to take a direct flight, or did you stop along the way?
No, we took. We did. We stopped in Hawaii.
Right, that's a good.
But that was our choice. We spent a couple of days there first.
That's always a good way to break it. I know that when I would travel to those areas, like even to Australia, I'd break it in Hawaii because it's such a long trip.
It is, but they do have, you know, there are many available direct flights if you prefer that.
Right, of course there are. Now, so why did you choose China?
Well, we thought, you know, it would be of prime interest this year because of the Olympics. And as I said, we thought that it would be a good time to go. And it was just really a good choice. But my husband made all the arrangements, and I was unaware of how he was making the arrangements. We had been checking all of the different tours available through United States tour companies for a long time and had noted where they go and what they see. But they were all very expensive. And so he arranged on the Internet through a Chinese travel company and sent our money there and got no paperwork in return, just an email confirming that they would meet us and have all the arrangements made. And then he told me about it. So I was very concerned and upset. I was afraid we'd sent our money down a rat hole and would never be taken care of when we arrived. But we went in good faith, and it turned out to be probably the best trip we've ever had.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I've talked to a number of people that we've had on the show recently, and they've done similar things and are suggesting that one at least have a look at it, and you can compare it with prices on some of the other sites that have this offering. But if you're going to a place like I don't want to call China remote, but if you're going off to a place like China, for example, and you elect not to take a package tour, then I think it's much better to go to a local receptive tour operator and see what they have. But it is a little disconcerting when all these paperless documents these days, and you just wonder, am I going to walk out of the airport and nobody's going to know who I am?
Exactly. And we couldn't find a package tour that fit the schedule that we could go on. And my husband doesn't want to be up at 6 in the morning and loading onto a bus every day. So
right.
The local, in almost any country, the local tour guides who can tailor-make a tour for you according to your own needs seem to work out a whole lot better. At least for us, they do. And then you can have a private guide and driver, and usually for less expense than traveling with a big group.
Right. Well, you know, of course, the other side of that coin is that you can find companies that have smaller groups rather than bigger groups, and some of them that are accompanied by somebody from the States.
Exactly. And Bill's idea, and he's right, I believe, is that the locals, of course, know their country better than some foreign tour company. And to work through them makes sense, and it spreads goodwill, and I think that's what we travel writers should be about, is making, you know, good connections for friendship and world peace.
Right. No, exactly. I couldn't agree more. However, having said that, a lot of the or I would say a good many of the U.S. tour operators use local receptive tour operators in the countries that they go to.
You're exactly right, and they are, you know, well-connected, and they do probably use some of the same ones that we go through by looking independently.
Exactly, I'm sure they do. But it's nice to have the flexibility.
It is. We booked through TravelChinaGuide.com, and they were absolutely excellent. We got five-star service all the way, and a private car and driver at each location. They met us at the airport. They arranged all the inter-China travel, and you know, all of our transports and everything, and had excellent service. And they, we were afraid. I was afraid of Chinese airlines, but we found out they were well-trained, and all of their planes were brand new, and it was just excellent service.
Yeah, they do.
And their airports are brand new because they were finished for the Olympics in the major cities. So we were really surprised. It wasn't the old China that we had hoped to be able to see. I suppose if you had the time and wanted to go into the countryside, you could see more of the old China, but we were amazed at the extreme modernity of China and how free they seem. They are, everyone told us that they're free to have entrepreneurship now, as long as the government participates in some way to make some, you know, some profit along with the individuals. And they seemed very happy, and the crowds weren't what we had anticipated. It was all just a very pleasant surprise.
Now, you went to Hong Kong as well.
Yes, we went to Hong Kong as well.
And what did you think of that?
We were there at a time which was not a good time to judge it. It was completely overcast with fog the 2 days we were there.
Yeah, we saw that at the Olympics as well in the beginning.
Yes, and we could barely see the beautiful bay that's in the harbor there.
Yeah.
But it was a very interesting city to see, and we enjoyed the marketplace particularly and our tour around town.
And let me just ask you this. How were the prices? And you went pre-Olympic, so they were a little bit lower, but was it expensive? Or?
No, we were surprised at how inexpensive it was. For instance, we stayed in a Ramada Inn in Shanghai,
right.
And I believe it was Shanghai. We thought, you know, when they told us Ramada Inn, we were expecting, you know, just a moderate, clean accommodation.
Right.
We walked into marble floors, extremely gorgeous, authentic antique furniture, gold everywhere, gold leaf everywhere, gorgeous flowers like you would get in, say, the Plaza Hotel in New York. Huge reception area, very large, very clean, extremely well-appointed rooms, excellent meals, complete breakfast with, get this, live piano and violin music at breakfast, and just everything you could imagine for about $95.
So it was a Holiday Inn that was really over the top.
No, this was Ramada Inn.
Oh, Ramada, I'm sorry.
We stayed in many of the, you know, familiar American name hotels,
right?
American chains, and were just amazed at the prices and the service. You know, you would expect to pay five times that much here in the United States for what we received.
Right, and then you went down to southern China, did you? Where did you go from there?
Pretty much all over to the major cities, flying from each place, you know, to each place within China. And we really enjoyed each of the places. In southern China, we were in Guilin, which is an old city, and it's a smaller city, although, you know, it's well over a million people, which sounds big to us, but to them that's just almost a small town. And it is a very beautiful town. They had one thing there that was most unusual to us. It's called the Waterfall Hotel. And people gather in this very large public area outside each night at 8:30 and look at this hotel, which I think was 12 stories high. It was a big, big hotel, long. And from 8:30 to 9 each night, lights come on to spotlight the hotel, and a waterfall flows over the top of the roof of the hotel down in front of all the balconies, and the inhabitants are standing on the balconies, so evidently they don't get wet. And then in time to music and lighting that plays sort of a dance on the waterfall continues in patterns for 30 minutes, and it's just spectacular.
And so then, now you were there 3 weeks, right?
We were there in China 3 weeks, yes.
Right.
Going to a different place about every 3 days.
Okay, and let's go from where did you went to Kunming?
Yes, Guilin. Let me go back to Guilin just a minute. It is okay. The place that you see in the ancient pictures with the river and the rounded mountains going up in the distance along the edge of the river with a lot of mist. And we took the boat ride down that a day cruise down the Li River. And it was just a beautiful sight. And at the end of the boat trip, they had arranged for us to take a bicycle out into one of the villages and have a home visit in the village. And we visited in a home that was 350 years old out in the countryside, and the same family had lived in this home for that many years. And they lived in a very primitive, but lovely way. And so that was quite a treat.
Right, and then you continue. You even mentioned that there's a. Did you mention the tiger and bear park?
Yes, and that was also in Guilin. A man in the early 80s had bought a number of bears and tigers and arranged this huge acreage for them to be on, and he was going to breed them for the purpose of selling their parts for Asian medicine because those exotic parts were considered very valuable for Asian medicine. And then it became illegal worldwide, and so the Chinese government has very strictly controlled him and made sure that he does not sell any of the parts. But they had 1,300 tigers and 400 bears.
That's amazing.
They looked to be in very well cared for areas where they had sort of their natural habitat. They could roam quite a bit. But they continued to breed, and so it was a most interesting place to go. They even had 100 white tigers.
Wow.
And they said it's becoming a problem to feed them all, and they even if they die naturally, they cannot sell any of the parts because they have to put them in a freezer, and the government continues to inspect that they are not selling any of the parts.
One of the questions I was going to ask is, how do they feed that many animals?
That's what is becoming a problem. So far they've been able to, but there were baby tigers there, and bears were breeding while we were there. So we don't know. You know, those questions were unanswered. They just said it's becoming a problem. And can you imagine storing? I think they said they had 100 dead ones at this point that they have to freeze and have freezer space for.
Oh, my.
So it is a problem, and I don't know how they'll solve it. They said there are too many of them to release back into the wild because they have been domesticated somewhat by being fed.
What type of bears are these?
They were either brown bears or black bears.
Okay.
I don't know, just
right.
Kind of your common bear like you would see in the Smoky Mountains.
Right. Right. And then you went on to Kunming.
Yes. Kunming was one of our favorite places. It is where they have the Stone Forest, which is a World Heritage Site. And it is just these gigantic mountains that are stone. I believe they're granite. They may be sandstone, but they appear to be granite. They're gray. And they're in strange shapes carved by nature and well-preserved and just beautiful. And in the historic park there, they have each week a different ethnicity or tribe, we would call it tribes, but they call it ethnicities, come from the mountains and the villages and perform their native dances in their native costumes with their local instruments for the tourists to see. So you've got a cultural experience as well as a beautiful experience in nature.
And
in Kunming we saw probably the most wonderful show I've ever seen. We all now have seen the gorgeous presentations they did at the Olympics in the evening shows and the ceremonies. And so you have some idea of what perfection the Chinese are able to achieve. A woman who was a show director decided to go to the local villages and view the different dances and songs and costumes of the old world, which is going to be lost. It has been lost in the cities already. And she chose the best dancers from each of 10 different ethnicities out in the villages near and in the mountainside near Kunming, and asked them if they would like to come to the city and help her put together a show. And the ones who wanted to do so left their very primitive way of life and moved to the city to perform in this evening show. Well, when they arrived, the woman was astonished to find out they had never seen a city or a car or a telephone or an indoor plumbing, so many of the things we just take for granted, and they just simply did not know how to survive in a city. So they arranged accommodations for them, and the troupe has, I think it's 25 or 30%, are professional dancers and singers who were, of course, used to city life. So those taught the 70% who came from the villages how to read and write and survive in a city and got them apartments and taught them the way of life, while the villagers were teaching the professionals how to do the songs and dances. And so they put on the most amazing show we have ever seen. They had over 100 drummers, and they performed the native songs and dances from the local areas, and they were just magnificent.
And it must have been a culture shock to see all of this.
Oh, yes, it was. And how wonderful that they're preserving it for the local people to see, too, because the young people who have grown up in the cities, the way of life in China has changed so much in the last 10 years that they really don't have any concept of what the life there used to be like. So it's preserving these old these heritage dances and songs and instruments and costumes, which is just marvelous. And then you see the costumes worn that you visit. And in the parks as guides. Those are the main places in the cities that you're able to see these anymore.
Lovely, lovely. Where did you go from there?
From Kunming, let's see, we were on to, we went to Xi'an, where the terracotta soldiers were found.
Ah, okay.
And that was just fascinating. Yes, anyone who's interested in China is familiar with it, but the building that covers the excavation, which they have done, is one of the largest buildings I've ever been in my life. They have excavated to this point 2,000 soldiers, all of which, except one, was completely broken. It was broken by the army that came in after the Qing dynasty, after the Qing emperor died. He had built this as his tomb, and he spent 40 years, I believe it was, building it. For the soldiers were supposed to protect him in the afterlife, and when he died and his son took over, they came. Another group from outside came in and had a war, and they came in and wrecked these tombs that they thought were totally safe. So all of these soldiers were broken back then. And when they excavated the tombs, they have put back together hundreds of these through, I think it's taken like 20 or 30 years for them to piece them back together. But as soon as they opened the tombs, the colors, the vivid colors, within 3 days were gone. So they know that there are many, many thousand more of these terracotta soldiers, but they're not going to excavate them until they know how to preserve the color.
Interesting. You also did the Yangtze River cruise, did you not?
Yes, and that was very fascinating to go to the Great Wall. I mean, not the Great Wall, the dam that has been built.
Right.
And
the Three Georges Dam. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
The Three Georges Dam.
Yes, the Three Gorges Dam.
Dam.
We were supposed to spend 5 days on the river, but we began at Chongqing, which was just 200 miles from the earthquake area, and the earthquake had happened 2 weeks before we got there. And there was some concern all over China that one of the dams would break and perhaps up in the earthquake area and perhaps flood some of the other rivers. And although they thought the Yangtze was well in the safe zone, they did cut our our trip short by one day, just in case. But we had a lovely cruise, and it was so interesting to see the way of life along the river. And fascinating for us to learn, you know, we've heard that, oh, they flooded all the villages and displaced all the people because when they wanted to build this dam, it, you know, made millions of people be displaced. But what we were told by the local villagers who had been displaced was that their way of life is much better now because the government came in and gave them a choice when they knew these villages down at the riverside were going to be flooded. The reason the Chinese, one of the main reasons the Chinese government was going to build this dam was that these villages were flooded frequently by just the local rains, and their homes were devastated, and their way of life was devastated, and it cost the government a lot of money to help them. And so to build the controlled dam would prevent this from happening. But because the dam is so deep, they had to flood many of these villages, all of these villages along the river. So the government came in and asked them, people, would you prefer to go and live with relatives in another village outside away from the dam? Or would you prefer to be relocated to a city? We'll provide an apartment and a good job for you. Or would you prefer to move to the village that we're going to build just like this one, way up high on the mountain where it would not be flooded, but it will be a new village, and you'll have an apartment, and you will have a good job. And so they had those choices, and all of these villages were relocated up the mountain with brand-new apartments and a whole new village before the flooding took place, and the people were moved safely out of there. So I was happy to learn that, and the young people that we talked to said their way of life is so much better because of the dam. The old people, they told us, didn't like it because they were being displaced from the home that they had known all of their lives and where their heritage was. But the trip down the Yangtze was very, very interesting and picturesque for several days. And while on board, I had a very unique experience. My knee, which had been swelling and giving me a lot of pain for 12 years, and I had been to many doctors and had all kinds of tests, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. So I thought when we were introduced to the Chinese doctor on board the cruise ship that we were on the Yangtze River, he had lots of wonderful credentials, and he practiced both Western and Chinese medicine, so I thought I was pretty safe in trying it. So I asked him if he thought he could fix my knee, and the first thing he said was, stick out your tongue. And I thought, can he see my knee from there? He looked in my mouth, saw the color of my tongue, and said, yes, I can help you. That's how Chinese medicine always begins, which was very interesting.
They look at your tongue first, huh?
Yes, and so then he gave me acupuncture in my knee, and which, by the way, is totally painless. And then he asked me if I wanted to have an injection of Chinese herbal medicine, and I said, well, if it's not Western, because I didn't want just a painkiller.
Right.
And if it's not animal, I'll take the herbs. So he said, okay, it's only herbs, and he gave me two injections in my knee. They were very painful. But after he did acupressure then to put the medicine where it was supposed to go, within an hour my knee was completely cured, and it's been 4 months, I believe, since then, and I've done lots of climbing, including the Chinese wall since then, and had no pain whatsoever, no swelling whatsoever. So I believe in Chinese medicine now.
And as long as they use sterile needles, I suppose it's okay. Did he give you any idea of what kind of medicine he was using?
No. I asked him to write it down for me because my thought was, if I die, then they'll know what was the reason. But he wrote it down in Chinese characters, so it didn't help me any.
Oh, that's funny. But that's great, and it's still okay. Huh?
Still perfect.
Honey, very, very interesting, and I understand that this article will be up on your website here shortly. Is that correct?
In December, we'll have an article about a trip to China, and I'll be sending you some for Destination Worldview as well.
Okay, and of course, your website is
realtraveladventures.com, and it's a free subscription. If you just go on the home page and click subscribe, and you'll never get any spam, just once a month, this travel magazine.
Bonnie, I thank you. It's always a pleasure, and we may be seeing one another in Mexico, perchance.
Well, hopefully so.
Okay. Bonnie, thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you again, Roy.
A pleasure. Our guest has been Bonnie Neely, a director of Real Travel Adventures, and a longtime travel journalist. This is Roy Lowy, and you're listening to Talking Travel on WTMY 1280. We'll look for you back here next Sunday at 5 o'clock. Bye for now.